Good morning. I'm Leslie Thatcher. 8:06 on this Tuesday. It's March 19th. 31 degrees and blue skies here in Old Town Park City. On the phone with us from the ABC Forecast Center, meteorologist Thomas Keyboy. Good morning.
Morning, Leslie. Happy Tuesday to you, and also happy first day of spring. The vernal equinox occurs at 9:06 p.m., so we're not officially in spring just yet, but we will be moving to that point this evening when the sun's rays are directly on the equator, spread across the entire planet, and our days will just continue to get longer until we reach the summer solstice. But even though spring officially begins today, it has been feeling like spring, and that spring feeling is not going away, at least any time in the near future, because we have high pressure keeping our weather quiet in northern Utah. Today will bring mostly sunny skies with a daytime high climbing to 52 in Park City, while we'll likely sneak into the upper 50s. Great day if you want to spend some time outside, and the winds should be generally calm, maybe between 5 and 10 miles per hour with those winds out of the northwest this afternoon. By tonight, we're looking at mostly clear skies. The overnight low heading to around 30 degrees in Park City will likely drop into the upper 20s down in the Heber Valley. And then our Wednesday will be more or less a wash, rinse, and repeat of what we get today. Another beautiful day, mostly sunny skies, a daytime high, maybe just a touch warmer, 53, 54 degrees possible in Park City. Then we'll drop to around 30 degrees on Wednesday night. The high pressure keeping our weather quiet will slowly start to move out of the way as we move into the second half of the work week. And with that high pressure moving away, winds will be out of the southwest. We're going to start to see some moisture move in. So both Thursday and Friday will bring at least a chance for isolated showers, roughly a 30% chance both days. But with daytime highs that are going to be hanging out in the low 50s for both Thursday and Friday, a good chance that we're talking about rain showers, especially since that chance is mainly going to be during the afternoon. We'll be at 51 on Thursday, 53 on Friday, with the overnight low holding steady around 30 degrees on Thursday night. So slightly unsettled to end the week, but I think for all intents and purposes, still should be a pretty nice close to the work week. With the high pressure out of the way, we'll start to move into a much more unsettled pattern by this weekend. Forecast model still pretty optimistic that a strong storm system moves in from the northwest. We'll send in a cold front along with it. Saturday still should be mild before the front arrives, a daytime high of 51, but that chance of rain will be increasing. And then once the front moves through, we'll be looking at a chance of snow. So on Saturday, we'll have the chance of both, as we'll see an overnight low on Saturday night drop to 29 degrees. And on Sunday, instead of a high in the 50s, we'll likely be in the 30s throughout most of the day. So snow showers look likely on Sunday, mostly cloudy. Daytime high of 39, dropping into the middle 20s on Sunday night as snow showers remain likely, with that overnight low of 26, and we could continue to see snow showers into early next week in Park City with that daytime high of 36. By the second half of next week, temperatures should begin to moderate again, but in the 6 to 10 day window, looks like we're going to see below average temperature, likely going to see some unsettled weather. We're just going to have to wait and see, just as we get a little bit closer, how these forecast models resolve the system moving in. So at the end of the day, spring feeling, sunshine the next several days, and then we're looking at kind of winter trying to make its comeback this weekend, Leslie.
Okay, thank you, Thomas.
You're welcome.
And with a look in the backcountry, on the phone with us from the Utah Avalanche Center, we've got Greg. Good morning, Greg.
Good morning, Leslie. Yeah, this beautiful stretch of weather has meant a kind of a broken record for avalanche forecasts. We start out at a low danger this morning, rising to moderate, and it's due to the strong sunshine and warm temperatures. So as the day goes on, the danger is going to be rising to moderate. Pretty predictable, though. It's initially going to be slopes facing east, then south and west. But I also think these warm temperatures can affect some snow on low elevation northerly facing slopes as well. So, yeah, pay attention if you're out this afternoon and you're on some shady north-facing slope at low elevations. There could be some wet snow that you'd be dealing with. We're also telling people to watch these corniced ridgelines. So cornices are these big drifts of snow that form right along ridgelines. We had a lengthy period of strong winds. So we have a lot of these ridgelines that have cornices. And as they warm up from sunshine and warm temperatures, they just will fall off naturally. So you want to avoid traveling on top of one of these cornice ridge lines or underneath one of these cornice ridge lines. And then for those that are spending time in the Salt Lake Mountains, this is glide avalanche season. And the terrain where you can find this are Broad's Fork and Stairs Gulch and Milby South and Mineral Fork. I personally avoid this kind of terrain this type of year because these avalanches are large, they're unpredictable. You just have no idea when they're going to run. So there's just some terrain such as Broad's Fork that I just don't go into in the springtime because of the unpredictability. The good news is there is some decent skiing and travel conditions, upper elevation slopes. People are still finding some dry snow. It's wind affected, but some dry snow. And also I'm hearing reports of some corn beginning to develop on those sunny aspects. So if you're getting out today, just watch for changing conditions as the snow warms up from strong sunshine. And yeah, it looks like we're just going to be kind of in this repeated pattern for the next several days, a little unsettled. But we're paying attention to the storm that's coming in this coming weekend, we're expecting, and we're likely can be back to wintertime conditions by probably Sunday.
Okay, Greg, thank you.
Thank you so much, Leslie. Bye-bye.
Well, stay tuned. Coming up on the Local News Hour this morning, we'll be checking in with Wasatch County Manager Dustin Graybaugh. Later on, I'll be talking with a couple of victims of radon gas, Bill Johnson and Connie Alexikos. Talk about how undetected radon in their homes caused lung cancer and how they're raising awareness statewide. Then KUER reporter Sage Miller recaps this year's legislative session and how this session was a bit different because it's an election year. The developer that owns nearly 1,000 acres in Richardson Flat has offered to build affordable housing there. KPCW's Connor Thomas reports.
Steve Cannon, the president of Master Planned Communities at Larry H. Miller Real Estate, made the offer during a public hearing about affordable housing in Upper Deer Valley. The Park City Council ultimately decided not to pursue housing on the mine bench, in part because previous development agreements deemed the area, quote, undeveloped recreational open space. Here's what Cannon said during public comment.
I just want to offer up that as owners of nearly 1,000 acres at Richardson Flat, we'd love to work with the city staff and leaders on options and solutions for bringing affordable housing to the area in perhaps less sensitive areas as well that are closer to freeway transportation, east of Main Street and the congestion here, and close to a park and ride where there could be circulation to help.
I need to ask you to keep your comments related to this item. Yep.
And that's it. Thank you very much.
Park City Mayor Nan Worrell had to interject because comments were only allowed to pertain to the mine bench proposal during the hearing. Cannon did express support for affordable housing generally. KPCW first reported in March of 2022 that Larry H. Miller had purchased most of Richardson Flat by way of two separate LLCs. Park City annexed the western half of the company's land, while Hideout was seeking to annex the eastern half. Both annexations led to lawsuits. One was dismissed and the other is pending. Larry H. Miller Real Estate is also involved in planning the Cedar Crest Village development in the northern part of Summit County. The town-sized development concept is under review at the Eastern Summit County Planning Commission currently. The Planning Commission canceled its March public hearing. The next discussion and hearing about Cedar Crest is set for April 18th. Connor Thomas, KPCW News.
On the phone now with an update from Wasatch County, I have County Manager Dustin Graybaugh. Good morning, Dustin.
Good morning, Leslie.
Let's see. The Wasatch County Council actually meeting in a special meeting today at 2 o'clock to canvass the 2024 presidential preference primary election. Any surprises there?
No, it's a pretty typical process for us.
Okay. And then what? Did we have basically the two top candidates then, Donald Trump and Joe Biden?
My understanding is that the presidential primary only applied to the Democratic parties. The Republicans decided to opt for a presidential preference vote.
Okay.
So I don't believe it would apply to Republicans.
All right. And then on the agenda for Wednesday, a proposed memorandum of understanding for animal control services within Wasatch County. So what would an MOU do here?
What we're trying to outline is a little bit of a plan for how we proceed with our animal care services. I think that there is, along with a lot of growth, comes all of the potential needs that are associated with that growth. And animal care is one of those needs. We currently have a facility and we feel like we're currently handling only just kind of the demands that we have, but we see that there's a kind of an increased demand for services as more people move into the county and rates of pet ownership increase, as well as if we wanted to tackle additional ways to try and handle animal care, like better facilitating adoptions and other things like that. And so the MOU is intended to address who's going to contribute, what's the level of service we're looking for, and how is it going to work going forward.
So the county is in charge of animal control services, isn't it? Is it not?
So right now, Heber City actually operates it as part of their police department, and the county, along with some of the other municipalities, partner with them in providing some of those services. So we do dispatching that helps with that. And the sheriff's office does respond to kind of farm animal issues, but most animal care services are provided by Heber City staff through an agreement. What we're looking at doing is making potential changes to that arrangement, though.
All right. Would there be any additional costs to the county then to do this?
I think there is an expectation that we would have some additional costs as we aim to potentially increase the level of service that we're looking for in this area.
All right. And that would come back then for final approval? Is this just a discussion at this point?
It is just for discussion. What we wanted to get input from the county council on if they're comfortable with the MOU as written, what changes would they like to see, and what are things that we would like to discuss with Heber City and the other municipalities as we move forward on this item.
All right. Wasatch County Planner Doug Smith will be presenting the new Wasatch County zoning map for approval. Can you highlight some of the changes that were made to this?
Yeah, so this isn't actually any zoning changes itself. What it does is it incorporates any changes that have taken place over the last year and changes the format of how we present those changes slightly. So it's a little bit procedural. I think, I don't know the details of all of the things that have changed, but largely all of those items that have changed have been done in other public meetings. And I think that there's not many of them overall. So what this would do is it adopts a map that's got a single view of the whole county and then makes those minor adjustments to the map.
Okay. Let's see. Anything else on the agenda that you wanted to run through?
No, we have a pretty light one this week. Last week we had some good discussions about potential administration building locations and RFPs and some other items, but
okay.
That meeting's available on the website for review if anyone has questions about it.
Well, I was going to run through a couple of those. At the last meeting, you did meet with Heber City officials to discuss the community reinvestment area. So is the Wasatch County Council on board for signing an agreement with Heber City on this?
I think that there is an appetite to look at options. I think the county council has been at a high level supportive of Heber City's goals for a revitalized downtown. I think there have been concerns over some of the specifics of what those funds would be used for and how long and how much. I think many of the things the council has asked for in the past are things that have been addressed now. Those include valuations of businesses downtown, and now that Wasatch County has contracted last year with a firm to help us update all of those values, that concern was addressed. There were concerns around the timing of when those funds would be reached, like contributions. That's I think about $3 million, a little over, that they're asking Wasatch County to contribute. So it would be potentially either 20 years or when we reach that dollar amount limit, so that the council has a little bit more confidence what we would be contributing. And then something we discussed as well is specific programs that Heber City is hoping to use these funds for. And I think that list could generate some discussion among the council of if there are things on that list that they feel like are worth supporting, that they would be comfortable dedicating the county's funds towards. But thus far, we haven't dived into all of those details just yet.
Yeah, so any specific programs you wanted to highlight, though, that you think would garner some support for this?
I think some of the things that the county council are interested in supporting is things like downtown parking priorities. We have had discussions about, and it's related to our administration building, on if we were going to sell the properties that we own in the downtown area. And Heber City's proposal is to potentially buy them using the CRA. So that's something that we're interested in at least looking at. But there are some other items on there that, you know, might rise to the level that the council's interested in supporting.
Okay, but you do, the council does seem to buy into the fact that Heber City is interested in buying property for parking.
Yeah, because I think there's an acknowledgement that parking is an obstacle when it comes to public accessibility and also redevelopment. Parking is at a premium in Heber City's downtown just because we have such a large highway going through the area. Access can be difficult, and I think that there is kind of an acknowledgement that if there were accessible public parking, that might provide some sufficient incentives to advance the redevelopment initiatives.
There was also a joint discussion between Wasatch County Council and Heber City last meeting about the Western Bypass. Is there consensus here by both bodies about the location of the bypass?
I think that there is a consensus on the need for a bypass. The council has consistently been supportive. I think that there may be some divergence in what the best alignment of that bypass would be. Wasatch County in the past, under previous councils, has voted to oppose routes that go through the north fields, just because we feel like that section of our county is really important open space, and that putting a road through that area would jeopardize some of the character of the community and the agricultural operations that take place in that area, which is core to who we are as a county, and part of our vision for who we want to be going forward is to maintain that rural character, that open space, as much as possible. But ultimately, it's a UDOT project. UDOT will make a recommendation. I think they're saying now by the end of this year, they'll have a draft EIS that will make a recommended proposed route.
Right. And certainly a few of those routes do go through the north fields. As you say, it is a UDOT decision. But are you running the risk by not having some kind of, I don't know, joint consensus here, you know, that you UDOT walks away from the project?
I mean, that's always a risk. You know, it's even if there was consensus, it's going to be an expensive and difficult project. I think any debate about these things is intended to be part of the process. And I think there's unlikely going to be any UDOT project that's not going to have some debate about why some group would prefer one route over the other. What we're hoping is that the county, through our processes, have sufficiently informed UDOT of the value of some of the things that we do want to preserve, some of our priorities, and that UDOT adequately considers those when they make those recommendations. So it's not, I think, about a concern that the county would be trying to stop the bypass, and that's the opposite of the truth. I think, like I said, there is a consensus that we do need one, but we just want all of the perspectives to be represented accurately in that final analysis.
Mm-hmm. Now, does the recent decision to acquire that conservation easement for the Gersh property prohibit one of the bypass routes from being built?
There's a couple aspects to it. One is that the conservation easement was voted to be funded so that Wasatch County is contributing to the property owner's effort to conserve their land. And ultimately, they could do that with or without the county's participation. Now, like I said, the council wants to make sure that their priorities are reflected in our land use planning and through these conservation easements. And by preserving the North Fields, they're sending a clear message that preserving the North Fields, even considering this bypass, is a priority. That said, a conservation easement is not an insurmountable obstacle for any UDOT project. State code, federal code, the conservation easement agreements that we use in our draft make it very clear that they can't be used to preempt or prevent a eminent domain proceeding. So UDOT still has the tools, I believe, that they need to be able to pursue any route. I think that there is an acknowledgement that maybe this makes the process a little bit harder. But I think Councilman Nelson said it best when he shared his perspective of why he was supporting the conservation easement, when he said that there are something to the effect of, there are many ways that we can address traffic and transportation. There's really only one way we can address preservation. So by preserving these properties, we hope that at the worst, we are sending a signal to UDOT of these things are important. And if the road does go in, we have now preserved spaces immediately adjacent to the bypass to prevent some of the commercial development that is, I think, a major concern of the county that a bypass might otherwise incentivize.
All right. Finally, I wanted to ask you about what did the council decide then about moving forward with that new Wasatch County Administration building?
They agreed with staff's recommendation to proceed to post an RFP and hire architects to begin a process. And looking at specifically property the county owns on the southwest intersection of Southfield Road and Midway Lane. So this is just across the street to the west of a county park, close to the new high school and Mountain Tech College that are going in there. So we're going to be posting the RFP this week, and hopefully we'll get good applicants and kind of begin the process of identifying the costs and the specific architectural needs for that site.
And what do you do with the existing building?
Well, that's part of the discussion with the Heber is are we going to sell it to them so that they can use some of that for redevelopment? I know, for instance, Heber City is interested in the fire station that the county owns a couple blocks south of the administration building for some of that public parking. And I think Heber City has shown in some of their downtown revitalization a redeveloped portion of this block. I think they would like this block to be, I guess, preserved part of a town square. And so I think the council is generally supportive of that direction as well.
All right. I just wanted to mention an upcoming event I saw on the website this Saturday, the Wasatch Community Self-Reliance and Preparedness Fair. This is happening from 9 to 1 at Wasatch High School. Pretty incredible rundown of what people can come learn, everything from ham radios to herbal medicine to raising farm animals.
Yeah, we're really proud of the effort that we put into between a lot of different departments and community partners to make sure that the public has tools available to, like you said, cover a wide variety of skills, you know, learning beekeeping or canning or other things that are general life skills, but also would be useful for emergency preparedness.
Great. Okay, Dustin, thanks for your time this morning.
Thank you.
Well, a group of non-smoking lung cancer survivors working to raise awareness and increase radon testing in Utah. In the studio to tell us more and what to look for are two of those survivors. We've got Summit County residents Bill Johnson and Connie Alexikos. Good morning to both of you.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Connie, maybe you can start and tell us a little bit about your story, how you got to this point in your life as a radon testing advocate.
Well, last August, I had just returned from a trip in Greece, came back and had a cough. Didn't know what it was. Had been fighting a cough for a long time. And finally, my GP sent me to get a CT scan, and lo and behold, I have cancer. And I've never been a smoker. I have lived a very healthy life. I'm 77 years old, and I lived a really long, healthy life, and was healthy, except for cancer. And we sat down at Huntsman, who has been great, and Dr. Puri, my doctor at that time, said, well, how could I have gotten this? And she said, well, radon poisoning is the number one cause of non-smoking cancer. And I said, what is that? And I've lived in Summit County or Salt Lake County for 20 years, and I had never heard of it. Just bought a house, 4 years ago bought a house, and didn't know about it. So I got online, ordered a test, and got to Utah Radon. My test was very high, and my son in Wasatch County was even higher. The numbers were incredibly high. So we immediately called Utah Radon, and they came up and mitigated. Now, if I'd known this years ago, I might not have cancer. I don't know. But I do know that testing is critical, and our radon, the rate of radon here, 1 in 3 homes could have high radon. So it is critical to test, and it's free. You can get free test kits. So it's a step that you can take that doesn't require anything except a test.
All right. Bill, let's have you talk a little bit about your story and how you got here.
Yeah, so in June of 2023, I was diagnosed with stage 4 non-small cell lung cancer that obviously blindsided me because I was an avid trail runner, mountain biker, skier, typical parkite, right? Managing two young boys, active young boys, so it blindsided me and my family, and I was just looking for some reason why. And so I can't say that radon caused my cancer, but I can say that, you know, again, as Connie said, you know, it's the leading cause of non-smoking lung cancer, and I wasn't a smoker. So really just trying to be proactive and reach out to the community and have them test. It's an easy thing to do. It's free, and test often.
Yeah. So have you tested your home, and did you also have high numbers?
I did, yeah, and I actually I bought a monitor for my home, and so in the lower level of my home, yeah, I tested high, and so I had to have that mitigated. obviously. And I still continue to monitor the levels in the house. But yeah, it did test high.
Yeah, everybody else in the family, though, okay? I mean, were they tested for something, or?
Everyone's good, yeah. I mean, so far, so good. We're definitely lucky that my wife is okay and my two boys are healthy.
Yeah. Had you ever tested your home for radon before?
Yeah, so we moved into our current house 14 years ago, and we got, the passive coal test and tested it, and kind of just, it was fine at the time. And so we just never thought about it again for the 14 years, right? And so I think what's important about radon is, you have to take the variables into account. So, different seasonal changes, whether there's snow on the ground, maybe the neighbor's remodeling and they've disturbed the ground a little bit. And so that can all affect the radon levels in your home.
Oh, that's interesting. So Connie had a cough. What kind of symptoms did you have?
Yeah, again, yeah. I mean, I was running and how this happened to me is that I was shoveling the driveway and I thought I pulled my back out because of last winter's epic snow totals, right? It was shoveling again. And so I didn't have, the typical symptoms, persistent cough or shortness of breath or anything like that. And so what happened to me is it was all on my back. And so so I thought I pulled my back out. I did physical therapy for months. And finally, in June, my wife and my physical therapist said, you got to go in and get an MRI. You got to check out what's going on. And that's when they found the mass in my right lung and it metastasized all the way up through my spine to my brain and then down into my hips, which pretty much made me immobile for a couple months. So, yeah. Shell-shocked, for
yeah.
sure.
Yeah, so you're doing better now? I mean, your prognosis is good? You're looking pretty good.
Thanks. Yeah, no, I think both Connie and we linked up before, obviously, and we're on, we take the same immunotherapy medication called Tagrisso, and that's done wonders for me. It's actually continuing to reduce brain and bone mets, but I do have some progression in my lung again, and so I'm on a new medication as well.
Yeah, so would somebody know if radon is to blame? I mean, is there any way to test the level in your body?
I don't think there is a way that they can say you have cancer because of radon. But it is something you can test and prevent it if you're testing regularly. And they can't say radon caused your cancer. They can't say anything did. Bill and I both lived really healthy lifestyles. I've never been really sick, ever, and have never smoked. Lived a pretty healthy life for 77 years.
Yeah. So talk a little bit about, your prognosis. You're doing okay as well?
Or? Right. Well, yeah. Well, I call it the magic pill, which evidently so does Bill and his family. And Tagrisso really stopped my cough. I had to have, it had metastasized to bone for me and other parts. And so I had a rod put in my femur, and it's attached with two big screws at my knee and my hip. But I exercise at least 5 days a week and still ski this silly mountain up here. So you just have to fight through those things. I feel good, and I will probably never get rid of cancer, but I deal with it. It hasn't changed my lifestyle now that I'm on this great drug. And as I say, Huntsman has been absolutely fabulous. So,
all right. Well, both of you, I guess, are on like a road tour to what? I mean, KPCW is a stop. Are you doing other of these, just trying to get the word out?
Yeah, I mean, I'm just trying to get the word out at any level, right? So I think that it's really, if you can build it into like your house maintenance schedule, right? So changing the water softener and anything like that, just order a test and get it done quarterly. So really just trying to raise awareness. So yeah, as many platforms as possible, I want people to get out there and test and be proactive.
Yeah, so I mean, is that testing that often recommended?
Winter, summer, spring, fall, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I think, so I actually use a monitor in my house, so you can buy monitors as well as the free test kits from utahradon.org. But the monitor, I can actually check the levels, it tests continuously throughout the day, and so you can actually see that it'll boost up in the middle of the night sometimes. And so, yeah, I think when I initially put the monitor in, it was summertime and everything was safe, and then the minute the windows closed in the fall and it got a little chilly and the heater kicked on, all of a sudden the levels went high. So that's really it. You have to test seasonally and test often.
Yeah. How expensive are those monitors?
Well, yeah, I mean, they're So I use the EcoSense models, and they're about $150 to $200.
Okay.
So, and then they give you real data, so there's an app and it tests like every 10 minutes or so.
Yeah, and you've both had your property mitigated. So yes. Has that kept the levels low, and that what, just provides some fanning?
It keeps it low.
Venting?
It is a vent that comes out of the house, blows it out into the air. My son, as I said, lives in Heber, and he was very high. And we had it mitigated as well there. So, and he tests, we both test frequently.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I live in an over 55 community. They built two new houses in my neighborhood a year ago, and it went sky high. I was shocked. Yeah. And none of my neighbors knew anything about radon either. So all 20 of us have now checked. And no, some are high, some are low in a very small community. So you can't say that because your neighbor was low, you're going to be low. Mm. You have to check.
Yeah, and so the fact that when levels went high again, the fans then kick on?
Absolutely. Yeah.
In your basement or crawl space?
Yeah. Well, the fan, I think, blows pretty much all the time.
Mm.
Yeah, it just drags it out of the earth and takes it up.
Okay, so why would the levels come up again then?
Because they've been digging. They dug two basements really close to my house, I guess. Mm. I don't know. All I know is that I'm going to test, and I'm going to preach it to everybody. Test and test frequently. And Bill gave you can also get on Utah Radon Services. Is that what it is? UtahRadonServices.org.
Mm-hmm.
Yep.
Okay, and you mentioned that it is a free. Actually, I did that, right?
So, it is free. Yeah. Did you test?
Yeah. Yeah.
And how were you?
I was a little bit above. So I'm going to retest because that's what they recommend.
Right.
Uh-huh. And then, but we've also heard it's important that you do it a lot.
Yeah, continuously. Yeah. Yeah. And I think I've even heard stories, locals in town actually, just by word of mouth, that even if they've had mitigation done and they went back and tested it and it was high again. So, and that could be because of, the continuous construction maybe next door.
Right.
And so, even if you have a current mitigation in your house, I think, it's advantageous to go ahead and test.
Okay, it does sound like, I saw some data that almost 3/4 of Park City homes tested for radon do have high levels. That's kind of scary.
Summit and Wasatch County, both very high levels.
Yeah, I think geologically, just Utah in general is very prone to it, right? So that's kind of why we're trying to really advocate at UtahRadon.org to get out and test.
Okay.
And I don't think that it is, you don't have to test legally when you sell a house here. I don't believe that is required, but it should be required by everyone.
Right, something you can negotiate then.
Right.
In terms of whether and who mitigates.
Exactly.
Yeah. Okay, anything else you'd like to tell listeners?
Thank you for letting us come and speak and just tell everybody that it's necessary.
All right, well, stay healthy, Bill.
Thank you.
Thanks for your time.
Thank you so much.
Well, as we've reported, the Utah legislature wrapped up its 45-day session earlier this month, and on the phone with a final recap, KUER political reporter Sage Miller. Good morning, Sage.
Good morning, Leslie.
So I'm guessing by now, you and Sean Higgins, who also covered the session, have had a chance to recover. We had, a record number of bills this session?
Oh my gosh, Leslie. Last year they passed 575. This year they outdid themselves with 591 new laws on the books. Well, actually, maybe not all the way on the books yet. The governor is still going through and either going to veto or sign them, or just they go into effect if he doesn't sign them after a certain date.
Yeah, honestly, could you even keep track of something that big?
Oh, absolutely not. I don't think any lawmaker on that hill could keep track of every single bill making its way through both chambers.
Well, the main job of the legislature, of course, is to pass a budget, and that they did. What's important about next year's $29.4 billion budget? It's basically flat.
It's also the largest budget in state history. And so there's a few, I think, key highlights within this. We got another tax cut, and that is specifically going to the income tax cut. The average family will see an average of like $65 or something along those lines back into their pocket. We also increased the amount of money to public education this year as well, specifically when it comes to the weighted per pupil spending. There was a 5% increase with that. And that's essentially how much money the state spends per student. And that wasn't because really the legislature wanted to. It's because they were required by federal standards in order to increase it based off inflation as well. What we also saw was a $40 million pot of money set aside for the Utah Scholarship Fits All program. And that was a controversial bill last year that tied teacher pay raises to essentially a vouchers program. And so while that program has not gone into fruition yet, they're still working on it, they did set aside $40 million for additional funding for people to take advantage of not using public school or either, you know, going to a private school or being homeschooled. Another aspect of this, and this has been a big topic, especially as we've seen a bunch of violence perpetrated around the nation, specifically in schools as it pertains to school shootings, is that they passed this massive school safety security bill that allocates at least $100 million, and there's about another $2 million ongoing in funding, to essentially put an armed person in every single Utah school, whether that's a school resource officer or what they consider a guardian, which is somebody who is trained and knows every aspect of the school and can help facilitate protection if a school shooting or a threat were to enter the school. And that person doesn't need to be a trained officer. It can be a volunteer within the school as well, and they could get a little bit of a stipend. But that money also goes to retrofit schools to make sure that they have the most updated security measures to keep threats out or help figure out how to funnel kids out in a safer way. And it also sets aside money to put panic buttons in every single classroom. So that was one of the big budget items that passed through this year that got a lot of attention because of the sensitivity around the issue.
Well, so at least it's a funded mandate, right?
Yes.
At least school districts aren't on their own here.
They are not on their own. They got a big chunk of money. I guess it remains to be seen if it's enough and if they'll allocate more funding next year. We did see some more funding when it came to water. We know that that's been a pretty pressing issue in the arid state, and not as much as we've seen in previous years, but they did allocate $10 million more to Great Salt Lake investments, and that's something that the Great Salt Lake commissioner can use to help advance efforts to kind of go along his strategic plan of being able to conserve water, find new water, and just help suppress dust, things like that, with the drying lake bed. So a lot happened in this session, very big budget. I won't bore you with all the details.
Okay, House Bill 119, this encourages teachers to carry a firearm to work?
Yes. So HB 119 was sponsored by Tim Jimenez, who announced that he's actually not seeking re-election in November. And this one, like you said, it encourages teachers to carry a firearm at work, and it gives them free training from the sheriff's office or a local law enforcement to help understand how to best use that weapon and protect the classroom if there was potentially a threat there. It also gives teachers liability protections if they were to discharge or brandish a weapon because they felt as if the classroom was under a threat, even if nothing happens or that it wasn't actually an active threat, but if they believe there was a reasonable expectation or a reasonable reason to be concerned about a potential threat, then they can be shielded from civil lawsuits or criminal lawsuits for that. Same with the school district. So Governor Cox has signed that bill into law, so that is in effect.
All right. In other education kind of news, House Bill 303 would have banned teachers from displaying pride flags in the classroom. So what happened there?
Oh my gosh. This was one of the bills that kind of reemerge on the last day of the session where everybody kind of spins their head going, what are lawmakers doing? We have about 2 hours left before y'all adjourn for the session. So yes, HB 303 would have banned teachers from displaying specifically pride flags or politically charged flags in the classroom as a means of neutrality in order to make what lawmakers, Republican lawmakers who pushed for the bill would argue a more inclusive inviting space where politics aren't a part of the classroom. You're just there to learn. And it failed. The Senate specifically said this isn't something that we wanted to take up. But then on the last day of the session, they tried to bring it back again in a different bill that was dealing with education. And essentially, the Senate rolled their eyes, said, we don't have time to deal with this. We don't feel like we need to take this up right now. And they killed bringing it back onto the floor twice that night. So it failed both times, and it may reemerge in the interim, or it may reemerge next session. But for right now, teachers, feel free to fly pride flags if that's what you want to do.
All right. House Bill 29, it's known as the Sensitive Materials Bill. Others would call it a book banning bill. What happened with this?
Yes. So Governor Cox has also signed this bill into law. He did it yesterday. And that one essentially just plays off previous legislation, making it easier for school districts to ban sensitive materials that they believe are harmful to children. A lot of these books that have been challenged in school districts relate to LGBTQ issues or race or sexuality that some parents just don't believe is appropriate for their kids to be reading. So essentially what this bill does is if three districts or five charter schools, something along those lines, decide that a book should be banned, it is then banned statewide. So no school district is going to be able to have that book if three school districts or five charter schools decide that the book is inappropriate. I believe that there is some retribution that this Utah school board can kind of try and fight back against that. But for right now, it really just makes it easier for certain books to not be on the shelves for students to read. But that doesn't take them away from like a public library or anything like that. It just won't have them in the library at school.
Now, we've got a minority kind of dictating what the rest of the state can read. Why was that the way to go as opposed to just letting parents opt out of having their children read anything?
That's a really good question. And I think that they believed if there was a consensus amongst the school districts and the school boards within those areas, then that was going to be enough to, rather than, just focusing on a handful of parents that are usually the ones challenging these books. But if the school board sided with them, then that, I think, was the pushback, or I guess the confirmation that the bill shouldn't be on. I mean, that the book shouldn't be on the shelves.
Okay. Is there a list somewhere then of these books, these sensitive materials books?
That is a great question. I bet you the Utah School Board would have them, or the individual school districts. But Martha Harris, our education reporter at KUER, actually grandma to see what books would be banned or what books are banned in certain school districts. And so you can check that out at KUER. They did a great job, some investigative reporting on it. It's not very updated to the sense of what happened this past session, but it does give you a good taste of what is not okay for students to read at certain school districts.
All right, thanks. Senate Bill 240 is basically the bill that says elected officials' calendars are not public. Tell us what happened here.
Yeah, so this was, if I could say one thing about this legislative session, is that it did focus a lot on transparency or blocking certain kind of abilities for the public to learn certain things when it comes to what public officials are doing. And this bill specifically does say that elected officials' calendars are not considered to be grammable, which is the Public Records Act for the state of Utah. So lawmakers or elected officials like the mayor or city council member can voluntarily give up their calendar. But if I, as a journalist, were to request what they were doing on paid time by taxpayers, I would not be able to could get that if they did not agree to want to give it to me. So that was also kind of a big I don't want to say it was necessarily a response, but lawmakers say that's how the law was always intended to be, that the calendars of elected officials were always maintained to be private. They were not supposed to be public. They were not supposed to be being able to get public records request. And some lawmakers say this was in the name of safety, especially for female elected officials, to make sure that people aren't acting weird or trying to target them specifically. And that even if they are public officials, they do have some, they still have some act or right to privacy. But this law comes right after KSL-TV sued Attorney General Sean Reyes for not giving over his work calendar. A judge ended up signing meeting with KSL-TV saying, no, Sean Reyes does need to give them their calendar. But now this law that legislators passed puts that ruling a little bit up in the air. We don't know what's going to happen. We do know that Cox said he will continue to release his calendar, and he urged all public officials to do so because he believes it's an important aspect of transparency, although he does support lawmakers on clarifying the language to say that calendars are not a part of grandma.
Yeah, it's easy to separate, though, a personal and a professional calendar. This, right? I mean, nobody wants to know about date night with your wife, but certainly on the taxpayers, you know, paying for it, of course we want to know who they're meeting with.
Yeah, and they said that even with the professional calendars, usually there's some touchy subjects or people that they are meeting with that they don't necessarily want to be public in the name of national security or state security or personal safety, things like that. And it soared through.
Interesting.
So we'll see what that means for the KSL-TV's lawsuit against Sean Reyes. I'll keep tabs on that because they've been fighting pretty hard to get access to what he's doing on the taxpayer's dime.
Okay. House Bill 560 dealt with the abortion trigger law. What happened here?
Yeah, so this one essentially was a cleanup bill. As you know, the abortion trigger law that would essentially ban access to abortion in the state of Utah is currently under an injunction by a judge. And then last session, there was another bill that dealt with abortion that essentially defined where an abortion could happen. And under that was Planned Parenthood was not okay. Abortions could not happen in Planned Parenthood, which is where one of the leading providers for the service in the state, that they were not going to be able to do that anymore. And a judge has placed an injunction on that. So what this bill does is essentially removed the quote unquote enjoined language in the bill, which is essentially the prohibitions that were in place. So it takes away the ban on Planned Parenthood not being able to perform abortions. And Carrie Ann Lisenby, the representative that was sponsoring this bill, said that they hope it clarifies and simplifies the language so the Utah Supreme Court will make a decision faster on the trigger law. So right now, abortion in the state is legal up until 18 weeks. So essentially, they don't want that to happen, and they hope that clarifying language in HB 560 will make the Supreme Court make their decision faster and that the ban, and essentially the entire ban, will go through. So we are still waiting on a Utah Supreme Court decision on the abortion trigger law, and there is seriously no sign of when that could be coming down the pipeline.
All right. I also wanted to bring up House Bill 432, a bill that has not passed did pass this year?
Yeah. So HB 432 deals with religion in the state, and specifically religious clergy, like a bishop or a Catholic priest, reporting suspected or known child abuse. So previous bills that have been introduced in the past, and they have failed. And that was specifically because they mandated clergy to report known abuse. This one doesn't have a mandate in it. It essentially builds a pathway for clergy to report child abuse to law enforcement. And in return, they get liability protections, meaning they don't have to testify in front of a judge about what they know, or they are also shielded from civil lawsuits if the perpetrator does decide to sue the clergy because they broke the seal of confession, for example. So the other aspect of this bill is that it can't be abuse known in the past. It has to be abuse happening in the present. And clergy can report if they were told in a confidential setting, such as confession, or if you had a meeting with your bishop. They could be told, like, they have the ability to go to a law enforcement officer to disclose what they know about that abuse. And that can happen on both sides. So it could be the perpetrator saying that they have participated in abuse, or it could be the victim saying, I have been abused.
Okay, finally, I wanted to bring up the fact that where did the golf course bill that would prevent people from finding out how much water they use end up?
This bill was so interesting. It died last year, a very similar bill, and it died again this year. The Senate did pass it. It was sponsored by Republican Dan McKay. And when it got to the House just didn't have an appetite for it at all. What part of what this bill does is that it gave a study on golf course usage to know kind of what better ways can we conserve water on golf courses, how are they most likely using it. But what it didn't do is allow the public to know how much public golf courses were using in water. The argument for that was saying, hey, these public golf courses, they already disclose how much water that they're using. There's no need to grandma it. We need to shield them from potential predatory practices of understanding water usage. I'm not 100% sure why they wanted to make an exemption for grandma here. But what I do know is that the House was not having it. The House, in a majority vote, voted to kill the bill, and it didn't get resurrected. So perhaps it'll come back next year in a different format, or perhaps lawmakers will just let this one go.
Okay, need to leave it there. Sage, thanks so much for your time.
Hey, thank you, Leslie.
Appreciate your reporting over the session.